lot of pressure to continue to say the war must be supported at any cost, because otherwise it means Russia can perhaps take over Ukraine or parts of Ukraine very significantly. But you're on an anti-war speaking tour.
Yeah, actually, for Ukraine, this is the war of self-defense, and I think it's very important to make a difference between, you know, the use of violence with the aim of aggression and the use of violence with the aim to protect your own existence. So this is why in Ukraine, as I said, all the civic and political organizations are united by this consensus that, you know, the political life in Ukraine, for example, the life of the civil society is possible under the condition, is not possible under the condition of foreign occupation, an occupation by a foreign army, which actually commit war crimes. That's why the support from other states and weapons are essential for Ukrainians in order to sustain their effort, in order to liberate the territory. This is not just about liberating the territories, of course. This is about liberating the cities where our families and friends are living under the constant threat and under the danger of being, as I said, raped and murdered by the occupying forces. And the fact that countries like our partners continue to sustain the military effort of Ukraine is really essential, but I don't think that Ukraine actually receives enough to be really able to be in a better position and to regain its territories and to, for example, start the negotiations from a strong position. The question of weapons is essential to us because it's the question of our survival as a society and of our political, economic sovereignty. Of course, nobody wants this war to continue, especially Ukrainians. But if we, like, I think we must remember that praising compromise with aggressor has never brought peace to anyone. It brought a total war. It brought a total war in 1939, for example. So when we are faced with this kind of state, a Russian state, an obscurantist, ultra-conservative, authoritarian force, we must act in order to defend such things that often we take for granted being here in the Western countries. And that's what Ukrainians are doing. If we do not support them in this struggle, and if we let Russian authoritarianism win, it will mean that the authoritarian forces also in our countries, in the US, for example, will become stronger. So this is basically one of the demands and the position that we share, both progressivists in Ukraine, both progressive forces, anti-war Russian forces. We share this perspective that the development of our societies, the peaceful life in both Ukraine and Russia is only possible if Ukraine wins.
Ilya, could you also talk about that, you know, where you see the war going, what the trajectory is, and talk about the changes that have been instituted domestically within Russia recently, in particular the controversy around new history textbooks that are being taught in high schools and increasing the age of conscription to increase the number of Russian men eligible for service in the military?
So, in fact, all your questions, they somehow related to each other, because all it showed that Putin basically is preparing for to continue this war. to prepare his population, his citizens to become soldiers, to become a war meat, you know, in this war, to give their flesh and blood there. As Anna just said, there are no any clear goals of Russia in this war. So it's always changing. So from one side, you can hear that Russia just want to keep the territories that it already control. In the same time, you hear regularly from Putin that the final goals of so-called special military operation must be achieved, and the final goals is control over all Ukraine. It's a regime change of Ukraine. It's what Putin called denazification and demilitarization. So these goals are still there. So it seems that his strategy is very depends on the conjuncture, on what he could gain. And he will catch from the situation as much as possible until he will be stopped in some point. So in this sense, I think that any, let's say, significant unsuccess of the Russian troops will create a true, you know, basis for some peace talks. Will give Ukraine a much stronger position in these peace talks. So in Russia, well, you see the preparation for the next draft. So the rise of the age for the men for the draft now came from 27 to 30. So according to new Russian laws, when you got the letter like from army in the same moment, in the same minute, you are not allowed to leave the country. Your driver's license will be suspended, and so on. So basically, it is very, very strict, very repressive type of enforced. Conscription to the Russian army. And then, as you mentioned, from the beginning of this new year in school, in the universities, the number of new courses, like so-called patriotic courses, were introduced. So, for example, in universities now it's obligatory for all the students to study a so-called DNA of Russia course. That means that the essence of Russian state, the essence of Russian history, which is a sort of perpetual war for the glory of the country, for the glory of the empire, the permanent expansion of its borders, somehow rooted in blood, in spirit of every Russian, and it's very much similar to the classical fascist ideas. For example, the idea of Benito Mussolini that the state is not just an institution, but it's a kind of spiritual force, spiritual entity. So all that is definitely very scary, and all of that mark the ongoing preparation for the long-term war from the side of Russia.
I wanted to ask Anna Perekhoda, you are a Ukrainian historian, you're a socialist, about the concerns of people who say neo-Nazis in Ukraine are being strengthened by U.S. support or the West's support for the war. We had on Ukrainian-American journalist Lev Golenkin, who said Azov is a hub for neo-Nazis to come to Ukraine from the United States and other places in the West to learn to fight, much like Islamists in different parts of the Middle East recruited Islamic fighters. Your response to this?
Well, there is a lot of things to say. First of all, about this mythology around and the fact that around this idea promoted by Russia that Ukraine is somehow has a large right-wing groups who are numerous and exercising a large influence on the Ukrainian politics. I would like to stress that even after the 5 years of the war in Donbas, after the Crimean annexation, during the parliamentary elections in Ukraine in 2019, the coalition of extreme right of right-wing forces only had 2% of votes and didn't manage to go to the parliament. So basically, Ukrainian parliament, you wouldn't find right-wing parties represented. They were represented before 2014, but now this is not the case. And also, after all these years of war, Ukrainians, which are supposed to be, like Putin says, right-wingers or even he called them fascists, they elected a Jewish Russian-speaking president who was openly opposed to the ethno-nationalist agenda. So right-wing forces in Ukraine, they do exist because, as I said earlier, Ukraine is a complex society, not a homogenic one, and it exists like in the other European countries. However, the right-wing, extreme right-wing forces didn't manage to become a legitimate political subject on the in the institutional politics. However, yes, they are present in the army, but their presence is now kind of diminished because, well, Ukraine has 1 million of soldiers now who are defending the territory of Ukraine, and 99% of these people are ordinary Ukrainians, not belonging to any political party, political force. So it's kind of strange to think that Ukraine is infiltrated, the Ukrainian army is infiltrated by the Nazis and the right-wingers. And you have also, well, at the same time, you have these Azov battalions, but they were under Zelensky losing their influence inside of the Ukrainian army. So I don't want to say that the problem of the right-wing ideas of the right-wing organization is an existent in Ukraine. Of course, it's existent. We as progressivist forces, left-wing forces in Ukraine are like facing this problem, you know, in a very concrete way, in a very personal way. But also, I think it could be an irresponsible thing to concentrate on the presence of right-wing organizations in Ukraine and to forget that the extreme right in Russia is actually in power and is currently waging a war of aggression, a war that is justified by the kind of discourse that could be called an incitation to genocide, though this is the things are kind of, you know, very serious. And it's kind of a pity that there is this disproportional perception of the right-wing threat in Ukraine and Russia. So, yeah, this is my response to that. It could be developed, of course.
Well, Hannah,
maybe Ilya could add something about the right wing in Russia.
We actually have to leave it at this point, but this is a discussion we will continue to have. Hannah Perahoda, Ukrainian historian at University of Lausanne in Switzerland, member of the European Network for Solidarity with Ukraine, and Ilya Budryatskis, exiled Russian historian and political theorist, author of Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia. They're on a speaking tour of the United States. organized by the Ukraine Solidarity Network. Ilya is now at the University of California, Berkeley. Coming up, we speak to Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, just back from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Stay with us. Singer Franklin Bukaka here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the dramatic deterioration in the situation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where rampant violence of armed groups has displaced more than 500,000 people in recent months. Overall, more than 1.7 million people have been forced to flee their homes.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo is also experiencing the largest hunger crisis in the world, with 25 million people facing starvation. The humanitarian response has so far failed to address the crisis. For more, we're joined by Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, just back from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Can you lay out the crisis as you see it in DRC and what the world needs to know, Jan?
The crisis is beyond belief, really. It's the worst hunger catastrophe on Earth. Nowhere else in the world is there more than 25 million people experiencing violence, hunger, disease, neglect. And nowhere in the world is there such a small international response to help, to aid, to end all of this this suffering. We are governed by humanitarian principles, and one of them is that needs alone should govern where we go and what we prioritize. And I would say, as humanity, we're really, really failing the Congo now, because it's not Ukraine, it's not the Middle East, it is that part of Central Africa where most children's lives are at risk at the moment.
Jan Egeland, if you could explain what led up to this crisis reaching these proportions, why are 25 million people at the risk of hunger, or facing extreme hunger, in fact, in the DRC?
Because such a large proportion of this vast continent, which is the Democratic Republic of Congo, is now engulfed in violence. You mentioned some of the displacement figures in the intro to this conversation. That's from one province only. It's called Ituri. It's in the north of eastern DRC, where I just visited. I was also in northern Kivu. In those two provinces, there are 150 armed groups. They are fighting against each other. They are fighting for territory. They're fighting against the regular army. And the civilian population is in the crossfire. So people are crammed together in abject misery in hundreds of smaller camps. I visited several of those. We are able to give some shelter, some food, some assistance, but only to a minority, really, because the small humanitarian appeal, you know, humanitarian plan for assistance compared to the vastness of the problem is one-third funded. The United States is giving half of the funding. Too much of the world is giving nothing. And now there is a question of perhaps even reducing that aid assistance further. It's terrible, really.
You know, Jan Egeland, it is not as if the world is ignoring the Democratic Republic of the Congo. In fact, the DRC produces nearly three-quarters of the world's cobalt, an essential component of rechargeable batteries powering laptops, smartphones, and electric vehicles. The reason I bring this up, we just interviewed Siddharth Kara, who wrote the book Cobalt Red. He said, the public health catastrophe on top of the human rights violence, on top of the environmental destruction is unlike anything we've ever seen in the modern context. The fact that it's linked to companies worth trillions and that our lives depend on this enormous violence has to be dealt with. Did you see evidence of this and how it links to the hunger we're talking about? Children age 5 and 10 working in these places, all the corporations that are making their profits, yet the worst hunger crisis in the world.
Well, I didn't see these companies and their extraction and their vast bank accounts. What I saw was the families, the children, the women, abused women who are suffering from the conflicts that are fueled by this black economy, by these economic forces that again lead to 150 armed groups not lacking arms, not lacking fuel. The neighboring countries are also, several of them, involved in all of this. So when I say, I agree with you, the Congo is not ignored by those who want to extract the riches of that place. It's ignored by the rest of the world who would want to come to the relief of the children and families of the Congo, because we have we've mapped this. No one in the world is there so little aid, so little media attention, and so few effective diplomatic initiatives to resolve the crisis.
So, Jan, explain where exactly you went in the DRC. You mentioned Ituri province, and the people whom you spoke to, a large number of whom, women you spoke to, who had survived sexual violence. If you could talk about that, what they told you.
I came via the most important town in eastern Congo. It's called Goma. It's next to one of the largest active volcanoes on Earth. I saw camps north of Goma in North Kivu, where thousands of people are crammed together on this volcanic earth. It looks like a moonscape, really. There is no water there. So why do people flock together there in subhuman conditions? Because it's safe from the armed groups who drive them from their land. One of these groups is called M23. It has roots from foreign interests, and they have been on the rampage of late. Women talk about tremendous sexual abuse, mass gang rape when they go out of the camps to collect firewood or do any other necessary business. Met a school master who had 40 pupils in each class until the latest influx of people. Now there were 80 school children in a small classroom every day, seven teachers on many, many hundreds of pupils. We helped extend that school. We built latrines. That has led to less cholera, but we're really overstretched completely. Then I went up to Ituri, which is in many ways ground zero now for much of the conflict. That's next to Uganda. What really shook me this time was to see people who had walked on their feet back from Uganda to where they fled violence 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, coming back to Ituri and saying, we were starving to death now in Uganda because no one's feeding us there anymore as refugees. We came back here. It's better to die in our ancestral land than to starve to death in a foreign land. And they, these women, had all stories of sexual abuse on the way because there were so many of these armed men on the road.
Jan Egeland, we just reported in the headlines about the massive hunger crisis in Afghanistan as well, and we've spoken to you in Afghanistan. The World Food Program saying it'll further slash the amount of humanitarian assistance it provides there, where more than 15 million people face severe food insecurity, blaming a lack of funding on the latest cuts, which will see the UN agency provide emergency food aid to just 3 million people. So you have Afghanistan, the massive hunger, and as you describe, DRC, the worst hunger in the world. And yet, our first segment was about the West pouring billions into the war in Ukraine. Can you talk about what needs to be done in a global perspective right now?
What we need are summit meetings to deal with this exploding hunger crisis. We cannot call ourselves an international civilization or a European civilization or an American civilization unless we do something to avert this chronicle of an announced famine that is going to grip from Afghanistan to the Congo, to Somalia, to Yemen, to the Sahel and beyond. The United States has been the most generous donor over the last 2 years. The United States is cutting 20% of its humanitarian assistance now from last fiscal year to this one. And next year, it will be a further cut in a situation where needs are exploding because of conflict and climate crisis. The Europeans are not stepping up and as they should be. And where are the Gulf countries, really, or the large Asian economies? I think we have India. You put on, you know, spaceships on the backside of the moon. Could you also help feed children in the Congo? There has to be summit meetings here where leaders, the bigger economies, have to say, we cannot let children massively die from hunger and neglect in 2023.
And Jan Egeland, just before we end, if you could talk about, you also looked at the number of children, in addition, of course, to the hunger crisis, the number of children in Congo who are being prevented from receiving an education, over one out of three, if you could, of every child in the Congo, if you could talk about that.
Yeah, and that's very important. I mean, why do we do education in a situation where people cannot really feed themselves? Because education is hope to get out of the misery. So even starving parents and grandparents say, please educate our children, because that could mean that our community gets out of this dependence. We cannot live under dependence forever. So hundreds of schools have been destroyed or closed because of the violence. But hundreds of schools are also lacking the basic equipment to be running. We in the Norwegian Refugee Council are able now to provide, as of September, thousands of children sort of catch-up classes. And these are, you know, children, youth. I met 14, 15-year-old people who have never been to school because they've been fleeing all their life.
We have 20 seconds.
And they are able to go back to school now because we got some funding from the U.S. and from Europe. If we got more funding, we could give to many more. There is hope.
Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking to us from Oslo, Norway, just back from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah-Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcroft, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.